The Committee on Rules Administration will come to order. Let's do the last three bills. I think they'll go fairly quickly. Senator Tomasoni, you have a late bill.
And Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that the reason it was late is because when we were in Senator Rest Committee, there was some question about what the bill was doing, and we were in Senator Rest Committee in a timely fashion. And when the staff checked to see where it was in the House, they noticed that it was in the Higher Ed and Workforce Finance and Policy Division, so they thought it was in the finance part of that division, whereas it was in the and so the information was that we could finish the bill the following week, and it was actually in the policy division.
We've had a couple of those, so
that's what happened. So.
Senator Clark moves that Senate File 30. Oh no, that the previous committee report be adopted. Discussion. All in favor, say aye. All opposed, motion adopted. Thank you, Senator Thompson. Okay.
Is that it?
Yep.
A good job.
Senator.
Chair, was that considered that it was late?
Yes, that was a late bill. Senator Dibble, are you doing the Murphy bill? Okay.
Somebody's got it. Well, the only issue that brings the Murphy bill is.
Right, just one sec. Is Vandeveer here? Okay, Senator Scott, Senator Dibble. We were discussing the Murphy bill 2540, and I think we're on page. The reason it's here is because of a commission with legislators on it, and that is on page 19 and 20. There have been discussions. Senator Dibble and Senator Murphy have visited, and I think Senator Dibble has a proposed amendment that probably would resolve the issue as far as the Rules Committee is concerned. And that is Amendment
A-19.
Senator Metzen moves the A-19. Senator Dibble, do you want to explain?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members. So what the A-19 amendment would do is it would take the legislative members off this council. This is the Council on Transportation Access that's designed to provide for some opportunity for some consultation among a variety of folks who are involved in human services transportation to more better coordinate that kind of service across different modes and jurisdictions. So we would take legislative members off. We would ask then that the council consult with the transportation policies in the House and the Senate on their work plan, and also to work with, coordinate their activities to the extent that they can with the transportation committees or an appropriate subcommittee. The idea would be perhaps to appoint a subcommittee of the Transportation Committee, at least in the Senate. We haven't talked to the House, but at least in the Senate, of interested folks from that committee who would like to work on and bring some focus to this issue.
And one of the things that was not apparent to me, and Senator Dibble mentioned this to me, this group of list of all these commissioners and so forth, apparently that group is in existence. They are working. And what Senator Dibble's trying to do is breathe a little legislative life into the activity so that that group knows that the legislature cares. And apparently it's a group that the governor has set up and has working. So I think this accomplishes where Senator Dibble was trying to get.
And I'm highly complimentary of the governor and that work that is continuing. We'd like for it to live on beyond his tenure.
Senator Byrne.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, I want to compliment you on this amendment, and I hope it can form a template for other folks in the future that might think we need to have legislators on commissions.
So on the A-19, then, I believe Senator Metzen moved that. Discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. And then I believe that's the only reason this bill was here. Senator Olson would move 2540 as amended, be recommended to pass. Discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble. Senator Vandeveer. He's on his way?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll start with Senator Rest then. Senator Rest. And as Senator Rest, when Senator Vandeveer does come, I think we'll set it aside briefly. Senator Rest Bill is here because it is a constitutional amendment. And it has legislative appointments, apparently. And it has legislative appointments, so it's a twofer.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 70 is the bill that is in front of you today, and it does indeed propose an amendment to the Minnesota Constitution to permit retention elections as a replacement system for keeping judges on the bench as opposed to our current system of contested elections. And when I spoke with Senator Pogemiller earlier in the day, he said that this committee would today concentrate on the wording of the constitutional question. As the bill has gone through the Finance Committee, we have noticed some cleanup language that needs to be made. And so I think that there are three amendments. One of them has to do with the parts of the bill that deal with the independent expenditures with regard to judicial elections. And is this better? I'll talk louder. Another.
That would be the A20. No? Which one do you want to do first? That one? The one you just
that
described?
One, that one be.
Okay.
Yeah,
which one is
whatever.
That?
I think it's
A23.
Or I don't know what the numbers are.
Describe which one you want.
It has to do with the independent expenditures, the 10A changes.
A22
amendment, yes.
Senator Clark moves the A22. Senator Rest.
And, Mr. Chairman, when we were reviewing this language, we saw that there was some redundant language that didn't need to be put into each section with regard to reporting of independent expenditures, 48-hour rule, a 24-hour rule, and this is a much more straightforward way of presenting the concept that was in those two sections of the bill, which are, if you look at page 4, for example, the reporting is to be done the same way for a 48-hour notice as it is for a 24-hour notice. You don't need to say the same language twice. You can just say it once and have it apply to both sections. So that's generally what it's doing. Also, it's taking out the word corporation because Campaign Finance Board Executive Secretary said that that would all be covered by just the word association as it's defined in 10A, and we did not need to confuse things by also talking about corporation as if it were different than an association, because in the campaign finance laws it is not. And then on line 418, the 24-hour notification and the 48-hour notification was meant to apply to the same groups, that is, individuals, associations, political committees, and political party units. And in the B paragraph, the word association was not not included. So it's pretty much a cleanup language for Section 6.
Questions by members? Okay, on the Clark motion, on the A22, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
And then, Mr. Chairman, there's the A25 amendment. And this applies to the last page of the bill with regard to the effective date. And it doesn't have anything to do with the effective date itself, but the language in that section says that if the constitutional amendment is passed, that the entities that are responsible for making appointments to the independent judicial performance, it should be Evaluation Commission, I believe. Oh, Performance Commission.
You want performance struck and evaluated?
No. We keep talking about it as being an evaluation commission, but...
This language is correct.
This language is correct, okay. According to the head note at least. And that the appointees that are being talked about there are those two, that Performance Commission, the Evaluation Commission, and that because of that, we need not only the governor and the Supreme Court, but the legislature also has appointments. And so we needed to clarify that we're not talking about appointments to the bench, but appointments to the commission. And I worked that, and Mr. Watson agreed that that was clarifying language that needed to be put in the bill.
Senator Clark moves the A to 25. Questions? Okay. Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, on that point of the name of the commission, it has more than one name, apparently. On page 6, where it's created, the head note calls it the Performance Commission, but the operative language on line 32 calls it Performance Evaluation Commission.
Right. And that's what I was jumping.
Later on, it's just, again, called the Performance Commission in section 17 on page 11. So...
Which would you like it to be?
It's Performance Evaluation Commission, and the head note needs to be changed in those sections which state otherwise.
Okay, so Mr. Watson, adding on to the 825, Mr. Watson.
That'd be on page 6, line 30, after performance and certain evaluation.
Mr. Chairman, you need it on page 4, line 433.
Page 4, line...
The head note there.
Yep, page 33.
And in the and on 5-1 to insert evaluation after performance. I think I'd catch these things.
And then on the amendment itself, you have to put evaluation in.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And also, Mr. Chairman, on page 11, line 10, insert evaluation after performance. Likewise on line 12.
Right. I think the word evaluation is a very important part of the title, even though it makes it a longer one. So.
Okay, so Senator Clark incorporates all of those changes. Unfortunately, it's IJPC.
I couldn't make an acronym out of it. So. Sorry.
Okay, on the Clark motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Senator Restlin, let's wait for 1 second and let's lay this aside. And Senator Vanderveer
here. Oh, sure. No problem.
The next amendment we'll have passed out. You're going to do the A24 next?
Yeah.
So
yes,
we'll have
I was.
A24 passed out. But. Okay.
I don't believe this is the current congressman we're checking
on. Okay, well, we'll wait a second then. Okay. Senator Rest, you're back.
Fine.
So we have the A24.
And Mr. Chairman, when members of the Senate are charged with making appointments, whether it is of legislators to any kind of group or working group or whatever, or whether it is the Senate making a public appointments, we've gone two routes. One is to allow the majority leader to make an appointment, and if there are two appointments, that the second appointment is made by the minority leader. But there was a lot of discussion, or at least some discussion, in the Finance Committee that when, and my own committee has done the same thing, that when that's often done as a matter of convenience, because if appointments need to be made very quickly, often the committee appointments is not, it's harder to get them together. And so the suggestion was made to return to that method of making the appointments to the judicial, the Independent Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission. And so the legislative appointments in this amendment, then, for you to consider would be made sequentially as follows. That first, the Speaker of the House, then the Minority Leader of the House, because they have a different structure, as you well know, and then the Subcommittee on Committees of the Senate would make the next two appointments, and we have minority members as well as majority members on that committee. And then, in turn, the it would be the fourth appointment would be made by the Speaker, the fifth by, or no, I guess it's the fifth made by the Speaker, the sixth made by the Minority Leader of the House, and then the seventh and eighth made by the Subcommittee on Committees. And the reason why the sequencing is evident from other parts of the bill, where it asks for the appointing bodies, the governor, the Supreme Court, and the legislature, to be cognizant of the appointments that are being made, so that there is geographic balance, there's gender balance, or at least that though, if there's not, we're not talking about half and half kind of things, but that there is that they're well aware of the appointments that are being made by the other bodies. And so, particularly with regard to the legislature, that, you know, there wouldn't be four appointments made by all from Hennepin County, for example, which we would, you know, assume has any number of competent people, but probably that we could find that a number of competent people from other jurisdictions as well, and that they could pay attention to that balance. Right, there you go. They might be one in Dakota.
Say Dakota County?
Senator Benson, were you guys going?
Well, I think we're drifting a little bit from the amendment. I agree with the 824 amendment.
Right. I think
I brought it up.
I was just trying to explain why the sequencing. Yeah, why the sequencing, that's all.
Somewhere else.
Senator Benson moves the 824. Discussion, all in favor?
Mr. Chair and members, I would like to have just a little conversation about, you know, in most cases, the committee, subcommittee on committees makes these. And you know, we work it out. I'm just wondering whether or not on this one, given the high-profile nature of this commission, the minority, I think, perhaps ought to have a stronger voice. And I've just penciled upon something here, Mr. Chair, and, you know, just for purpose of discussion, for instance, on line 1-8, after members, upon recommendation of the majority leader and the minority leader, respectively. And I think it just says to me that
the subcommittee makes it upon that recommendation.
Yeah,
that'd be fine.
Of you and I,
that'd be fine.
Or whoever follows us.
Yep. I think that's a good idea.
I think it just puts a better tone into that.
Yep.
Because this can be a partisan committee. That's the way it is. It'll always be that way.
This committee?
Irrespective of who's in control, it will be partisan.
No.
You know that.
Sure will.
I think it's a good,
yes,
a good addition,
Mr. Watson. What would that? How would you put that in there,
Mr. Chairman? On page 1, line 7, after administration, insert a comma, on recommendation of the Senate Majority Leader and Senate Minority Leader, comma.
Senator Metzen and
I don't know. Does that get you back to where we were before we put the amendment on?
No.
Mr. Chair and members, it would just be that I think it suggests that the majority leader and minority leader have to come together and kind of present, if you will, a slate of two people. And when that presentation's made, that's kind of what we've agreed on.
All right.
So you'd incorporate, Senator Metzen, the way Senator Rest, aside from this rotation thing, the intent here is not to necessarily appoint a Democrat or Republican. The intent is to get really high-quality people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sure.
Be they Democrat or Republican.
Or of no political affiliation,
or no
which
political
is just as likely.
So. Any it's a fairly large group, isn't it? 24 members?
That's correct.
So it's not like there's going to be this close vote.
The only thing that is a requirement is that no more than half of them from any appointing authority may be attorneys.
Good.
Just kidding.
For those in the room here.
Pardon me, Senator.
Like 90% of them are attorneys, right?
Senator Metzen then has the A24 as amended, as incorporated. He incorporated the Senjum language. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for
Senator,
considering those amendments.
There is going to be some testimony. Senator Berglund, you had a question?
Yes, I have a question for you, Mr. Chairman. Is this the only constitutional amendment that we would be considering? Are there others?
Of course, I don't have that sole authority.
Well, I understand that, but, I mean, are there others out there floating around through within the legislative process? Because, yes. As you know, it's not a good idea to put too many constitutional amendments on the ballot.
There are three that I'm aware of. One has not had a hearing in any committee yet. Senator Murphy has one that is in the committee that has something to do with if you're called to military duty, you get to appoint someone to replace you in the legislature while you're gone. The legislature, yes. I don't know whether we're going to proceed with that one.
Senator Cohen has an amendment about the special sessions.
Senator Cohen has one about special sessions. Is that here already? Okay.
Well, I just kind of like to know how many there are and what the choices are before I get too serious about considering.
Mm-hmm. Senator Vandeveer has a constitutional amendment of some sort. What does Senator Vandeveer do? Oh, it's like the Murphy one. It has to do with...
Well, Mr. Chairman, it appears that this one has had the most vetting in the process so far. I don't know if that's the case in the House, but it certainly has in the Senate.
I think it would be fair to say what I'm aware is this appears to be the one that the House and the Senate are most interested in getting on the ballot. Don't know if it's going to get there, but I'm just saying I have not heard any pressure from the House on anything else. And today I just want to give a heads up. The intent was not to move the bill out today, and you'll see why in a few minutes, but to allow people to think about this a little bit and kind of start to expose it for discussion.
The reason I'm asking the question is because it's part of my thinking about it.
Part of your what?
It's part of the process that I use when I'm thinking about things.
No, it's fine.
So, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ress, will you go to me to page to line 731?
Okay. 7.31?
Yeah. And so when I read that line, in case of a vacancy on the commission, the authority, and then I think about what the authority is, and it seems to me it's either the governor, the Supreme Court, or the legislature.
That's correct.
But in the case then, if it were the legislature then who appointed the member, what, for instance, if the speaker's nominee or appointment was that if that seat became vacant, it still says the legislature, it doesn't say the speaker.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to, if you get what I, you know, is it, would it be the four leaders coming together and appointing a person, or would it be because the speaker's seat was vacated, the speaker fills, or if the minority leader's seat was filled, they fill? Because I don't view us, or at least these titles, as the authority.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Senjum, it is my understanding, because of the way of the rotation, et cetera, that it would be the minority leader's appointment in the House, or the majority leader, or the speaker's appointment, or if it was one of the Senate appointees, that the appointing authority is as defined in this instance in paragraph 3, beginning on 723. We've just amended that with the language of the A24 amendment. But if the appointments that had been made by the Senate were vacated, they wouldn't become the Speaker's appointment to fill them.
Madam Chair, now I'm thinking, for instance, though, what if a House appointment was?
Then the Senate would not be able to fill that appointment.
But the authority would.
No, the appointing authority is for the legislature, is that rotation that I mentioned. The Speaker gets an appointment. The appointing authority.
I'm just pointing out something when I read it, you know, and when somebody reads it 10 years from now, I think they're going to wonder about what that really means.
Mr. Chairman,
the one thing that's different from this phrase is usually we would say appointing authority, but here we say the authority that made the appointment. It's the same thing. And it's whoever made the appointment. It's a sort of a standard term in governmental operations circle, appointing authority. Whoever made the appointment, it could be an individual or it could be a group.
And Mr. Chairman, it's a part of the segment that's on is pertaining to the legislative
budget. Anyway.
It's not a separate standalone thing, so it's within that structure of that appointment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, then, with regard to the language, I thought maybe I would review the evolving language in the ballot question from the time when the bill was introduced last year to changes that were made.
What it says now.
Okay.
Read the history. Just tell us
okay.
what it says now.
If you look on page 2, the question to be submitted is, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to reaffirm the impartiality of the judiciary by providing that all judges be appointed by the governor with their continuation in office determined at a retention election after a public, nonpartisan evaluation of their performance by a, and I guess we didn't report, we didn't continue that language, but by a judicial performance commission rather than be determined under the current system of contested elections. And it has gone through, I will just say, if members want to know, it has gone through an evolution to get at this language.
Do you want it, should it have performance evaluation in there?
Well, I think in the instance here, since we talk about an evaluation within the same sentence, I'm not sure we need to to add the that other word evaluation, although it certainly wouldn't hurt. Although, actually, we ought to change it in the in line 123 if we want to repeat that language that we have now put in the rest of the bill, which might be just a really good idea. So it's crystal clear.
And Senator Rest, you've got performance there twice too. So
I know.
It may be
sometimes redundance is a good thing.
So evaluation would be
In order.
So we should add the word.
Mr. Chairman, I would support adding evaluation after performance on 211, and then in the change made in the Constitution itself on line 123 to insert. After performance,
Senator,
the word evaluation.
Senator Clark moves those two additions. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay, Senator Rest, probably be better to have pro testimony on the language.
Okay.
I think that'd be appropriate.
All right. There are some folks out there. I don't know. Maybe Senator Vandeveer is ready, though, since this is a natural break.
We have your bill. Senator Vandeveer, why don't we do that?
Yeah.
Let's set aside Senator Rest's bill for a second. Okay. Okay. So we're going to be looking at the committee report that came out of Senator Rest's committee. Senator Vandeveer, you are here because this is a late bill?
I didn't think so, but apparently
Mr. Watson, what's the, just is it straight up late, or what's the issue?
Mr. Chairman, it is a straight up late bill, and it's a late bill because of an unfortunate combination of circumstances, where the bill in the Senate made it out of Commerce and Consumer Protection by the first deadline, but then and went to the Finance Committee, but then it was withdrawn and sent back to state and local government after the first deadline. So it made it out for the first time, but then before the second deadline, it was back in a policy committee. At the same time, the House bill was having a similar course through the legislature. The House bill made it out of the Commerce and Labor Committee on March 16th, which would have been perfectly fine if the Senate bill, which made it out of the Senate committee by the first deadline, had stayed out of the Senate committee by the first deadline. But the Senate bill went back, so we didn't have a bill that had made the first deadline in the Senate, so the House bill
Senator Senjum moves the previous committee report. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
Good job.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, Senator Rest, are you ready to have some pro? The focus of the Rules Committee is to talk about the exact language of the ballot question. We can obviously deal with any part of the bill we want, but why don't we focus on that right now? And Senator Rest, who's going to testify on that?
Mr. Chairman, I have two people.
Okay. Welcome. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leo Brisboy. I am the current president of the Minnesota State Bar Association. We have almost 17,000 members all across the state of Minnesota. I also have the privilege of being the chair of a group of organizations that are supporting this legislation called the Coalition for Impartial Justice. It's a very diverse group, and both politically, ideologically, it's mostly non-lawyers, which is a good thing, even though I'm a lawyer. this isn't just a lawyer's bill. This is a citizen's bill. To the extent that the language in front of you for the constitutional amendment, let me cut right to it. The State Bar Association and as chair of the Coalition for Impartial Justice, so I'm actually wearing two different hats, they support the language as it is, as it currently is before the committee. There has been some discussion, and I imagine you'll hear some of it today, as to why there is not a mandatory merit selection language in the constitutional amendment. And I will speak pretty much briefly just to that and why we don't believe both the MSBA and the Coalition for Impartial Justice believe that is necessary. The mandatory selection, merit selection or merit selection, whatever, however you want to describe it, is not something that needs to be done constitutionally. And I say that from experience. I have the privilege as an individual to serve on the Commission for Judicial Selection, which vets applicants and nominees for the 284 district court seats in the state of Minnesota. That is a statutory body. It does what we are all concerned about, is vetting qualified individuals for who are interested in serving the citizens of the state of Minnesota on the judiciary, and it works very well. And to the point that was made earlier about the makeup of the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission, did I get that right? Okay. Yeah. About the appointees having to not more than half being non-lawyers, I will tell you that of the 49-member Commission for Judicial Selection, which currently exists in Minnesota, half of them are non-lawyers, and it works very well. Minnesota is ranked number 2 nationally for competence, and it is ranked number 5th nationally for impartiality, based on essentially a de facto merit selection process, because over 90% of Minnesota's judges, and predominantly 95% of the trial court judges, first come to the bench through that merit selection or that commission on judicial performance process. So this bill does not make a major change into what we do in Minnesota. It simply addresses whether we have contested elections at the front end or retention election at the back end. Merit selection is not a constitutional issue. It is a statutory issue. And it can, if it needs to be extended to the appellate courts, the 26 judges, it can be done by amending 480B. And that, as a matter of fact, I am aware that there is separate legislation introduced in the Senate and in the House to do just that. And I will tell you that the State Bar Association supports that legislation. I will tell you, wearing my other hat, that the Coalition for Impartial Justice supports that legislation. And we will support it this year. And if needs be, after the constitutional amendment passes in November, we will be back to support it next year. But the merit selection already exists. It exists for over 90% of our state court judges. And it does a good job. But it's there because of a statutory creation. It does not need to be in the constitutional amendment.
Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome, Governor. It's an honor to have you here.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Al Cui, and I am a former member of the State Senate of Minnesota. And I had the opportunity to be the first person who was governor with the performance or the Judicial Selection Commission. Now, the question is, are we going to let the voters decide this question, or are we going to stop it here? So let's look at the first at the present Constitution, the way it is now. Voters go to the poll, and they have no clue about the performance of any judge or justice. And every one of you know that, because people ask you, who should I vote for? Secondly, the voters have a voice only in about 10% of the judicial races where they attract an opponent, and voters still don't know much about either of them. Thirdly, the voters don't have a voice in 90% of the judges that are running. They can only vote yes. Most countries get rid of that system of voting. Now, what will happen if the constitutional amendment is passed? In that case, voters will be informed by the evaluation of a commission made up of competent, highly respected, diverse individuals, and it'll be known. And the voters will be able to make a decision by yes or no on every judge who stands for election. Now, we have some opposition. The district court judges don't like it. Why? Because we don't have in the Constitution the language mandating a judicial selection commission. 33 states in the Union have judicial selection commissions. 11 of them, including Minnesota, does not have it in the Constitution. As our experience with 3 Republican governors and 1 independent using this is a respected way in which we select judges now. And I believe adding the appellate system to that will have no problem, because in a way it's working now, but if you can put it into law. The only thing that'll stand in the way is if the governor wants to then make his decisions based on the way we did it prior to Judicial Selection Commission working. The second part is that there are some individuals who are opposed to this, and they're here in this room, because they look at the democracy, free speech has to include contested elections as well. Well, that means in the federal system we have not been operating under democracy for our whole 200 and some years so far. The question is how we do that. Do you want to be involved in ideological battles in order to get judges who will decide on your side, like Texas? Well, we're not like Texas, but we're like Wisconsin. Because of those elections where more than $10 million was spent, it is no longer classed as a liberal Supreme Court. It's now classed as a conservative Supreme Court. Do we want that to happen within our state? And the last one I want to mention, because you ought to have that, because it's been under the surface so far, the MCCL is opposed to this. Now, I had a 100% pro-life voting record when I was in politics. And it's scary if an organization where you've been 100% on their side and people look at that in the voting on how they're going to decide if you err from their decision. I've faced that. Someday you will be introducing yourself as a former Minnesota State Senator. When you were faced with it, can you look back? I voted right, even though I was defeated for it. And you won't be defeated, because I talk to folks who think like I do in this way, and they catch it. It's the only people who are involved in politics that wonder about the power play in this. The rest of the people, when you talk to them, they catch it quick, and they're so relieved there's a possibility that they can go to the polls and vote for judges that they know how they perform. That's what I wanted to say to you.
Questions?
Very good.
Thank you, Senator.
That was an honor.
Mr. Chairman, there are others in the room if there are particular questions, but that would be the substance of my testimony, and I just concur with the
I concur with the presentation made by both Mr. Brisbois and the governor, particularly with regard to judicial mandatory merit selection. I think some members may not know that the Senator Pogomiller is the author of the legislation establishing the Commission on Judicial Selection a number of years ago. We do have a bill in front of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee, which will be heard next Wednesday afternoon, that sets up a system of mandatory selection. It is one that I support. But as Mr. Brisbois indicated, you can have that in the statute. We are not prohibited from having mandatory judicial selection in the statute. However, we cannot change to a retention system without making a change in the Constitution, and that's why we're here with a ballot question that's limited at this point to retention elections. And I think that on occasion, just because someone, maybe it happens, but just because we have a proposal that we fear the any governor may veto is not a reason to put your proposal on the ballot as a constitutional amendment.
Okay. Testimony against the particular language, and perhaps even since Governor Quay and Senator Quay went a little broader, we would also take testimony against the constitutional amendment. So, on the particular question itself, yes. Mr. Wurzel, I know you want to testify, right?
Thank you.
So you can get there, Judge, or Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I do intend to confine my remarks to the constitutional amendment before you. Thank you for the opportunity to submit these comments to, I'm Susan Miles. I'm president of the District Judges Association. I've been sitting in Stillwater as a district court judge for over 13 years now. I've been president of MDJA for over 6 months now and have been long involved with MDJA's efforts to come up with a position on this general topic that's before you today. The concepts in the bill before you today have been the subject of discussion within our organization since before the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in 2004 in Republican Party versus White. Until a year ago, our position was in favor of the status quo, that is, in support of contested popular elections and against retention elections. Last year, we vacated our previous position and referred the matter for further study by our Judicial Selection Committee chaired by Judge Tim Connell out in Rock County. We asked the legislature to focus instead on the judicial branch budget while we reconsidered our position. Then in September of last year, our membership overwhelmingly passed the resolution on the last page of the report and recommendations dated August 19, 2009. I hope copies are available to you. Since last fall, we have worked hard with Senator Rest and others to come up with a bill draft that addresses MDJA's concerns about changes needed to preserve an impartial judiciary. While those discussions have resulted in several changes which we support, Senate File 70, as it currently stands, fails to address MDJA's central concern with which this committee has jurisdiction, that is, mandatory merit selection. Accordingly, we cannot support the bill in its current form. A retention election system that does not include mandatory merit selection is an empty promise. Senate File 70 does not include any provision for merit selection, leaving the current inadequate system in place, with all due respect. At present, merit selection applies only to district court judges, and its employment by any governor is entirely voluntary. Just as important, appellate judges are not even subject to the merit selection process. Without mandatory merit selection, any assumption that this massive overhaul to judicial selection will automatically produce qualified appointees simply is incorrect. Such a voluntary approach to merit selection obviously opens the door to politically based appointments at all levels of the judiciary, and once in office, these judges would be very difficult to remove through a retention election. A retention election system is like a three-legged stool. In addition to the retention elections, there must also be mandatory merit selection and performance evaluations. We support adding mandatory merit selection in the constitutional amendment. In closing, MDJA's position is that before the public is asked to vote on a constitutional amendment to give up their right to vote for judges in contested elections, the proposed replacement had better be bulletproof. As a major stakeholder in the outcome of this debate, MDJA will be vigilant that the public's interest in an impartial judiciary is protected. Without including mandatory merit selection in the constitutional amendment, Senate File 70 fails to meet that objective at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any questions?
Questions? Is there specific language that exists on how you would like to see the question?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Section 1 of the bill, which is the constitutional amendment, the amendment to Section 8 of Article 6 would read as follows. Whenever there is a vacancy in the office of judge, the governor shall appoint, in the manner provided by law, a qualified person to fill the vacancy from a list of candidates nominated by a selection commission in the manner provided by law. Section 2 of Article 1 of the bill.
What might be easier is if we Xerox that off. Is that okay? In the form we could Xerox it off?
And absolutely.
Let's do that, and then that'll be a little easier for members.
Okay.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge, are you suggesting that the retention election and the evaluation by this commission would not be able to make corrections in bad decisions made by a governor who chose not to follow the merit selection? I mean, we've got that in statute. And I think, as far as I know, it's been followed all the way through, maybe not 100% all the way through the appellate, but if they're standing for election and go through this, if this system would work, why would that not allow for the corrections if there was error made on the part of the governor in the process he used for selection?
Senator Olson, members of the committee, first of all, the appointee by the governor would sit for 3 years before they ever have to run for retention and be evaluated. So a lot of damage can be done in 3 years' time. Second of all, and more important, is that there is a reasonable doubt, the way the bill is currently drafted, as to whether or not the governor would follow the merit selection process. Certainly, as we're about to find out, I think, with respect to appointing the replacement for Chief Justice Magnuson, the merit selection process won't be used at all. But with respect to appointing replacements for district court judges, there is that reasonable doubt that the governor would not follow the tradition of merit selection as we have known it. You only get so many chances to amend the Constitution, and MDJA's position is when you do get that chance, you should do the right thing and include the third leg of the stool in the proposal.
Others? Okay, thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Senator Senjum.
Anyone else speak in opposition to the bill?
I would like to speak.
Gordon?
Excuse me.
You're doing good.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Greg Wursel. I'm an attorney. I've practiced law for 30 years, and I was a lead plaintiff in the White case. I'd like to, first of all, say I agree entirely with the presentation that was just given by the District Judges Association. I strongly disagree with the idea of retention elections at all, but if we must have them, then let's at least have them where they would work. The supposed purpose of this is to prevent impartiality, but if all judges are going to be selected by a governor and there is no check or balance at all on the power of the governor contained in the bill as written, then we are not going to have an impartial judiciary. We are going to have a judiciary that is in the mind of the governor, whatever that might be. And I think that's exceedingly dangerous. I think we're giving way too much power to the governor. And that's why I think the idea that you cannot, that the Judicial Selection Committee should be mandatory if you're going to have a retention election. I would like to also comment on Governor Quay gave a very stirring speech. I would only point out that for years and years and years, elections did not work in this state. The voters didn't know who they were, the judges were, or why they should vote for them. And yet, we didn't have any movement by the judiciary or anyone else asking for a change in that system. I suggest to you that we're here today not because that system doesn't work. We're here today because they're afraid that since the White case, that system might work, and that if elections start to actually work and we actually have competitive elections, many of the people in this room are going to be facing real elections and might actually lose their positions of power. That's why we're here today. I don't believe for one second it has anything to do with helping the public. It has to do with preserving their positions of power. And with regard to the specific language of the wording that's going to be appearing on the ballot, Mr. Chairman, I do have a strong objection to some of the language. Specifically, if you look at lines 2.8 through 2.9, it says it shall be amended to affirm the impartiality of the judiciary by providing. My suggestion to you is the language to reaffirm the impartiality of the judiciary should be struck entirely from what will be on the ballot, because there is no way you can tell me that this system that is proposed is going to create more impartiality than the system we have now. It also, when you present a constitutional amendment to the public, you want to present it in as fair and as balanced a way as possible. What they are trying to do with that language is key the voters. All voters are going to say they want an impartial judiciary. This says it's going to make it even more impartial. How that's going to happen, I don't know, when everyone is appointed by the governor. And so my suggestion to you is that language should be struck from the ballot issue. The final problem...
Russell, could I just ask, is your point there that you think that language is presumptuous?
Yes, because there's no way we can know that the system is going to create more impartiality, and I think it's destined to create more impartiality, not less.
More partiality,
excuse me. Yes, you're correct. I also have strong reservations about calling something a judicial performance evaluation commission, when in fact we are prohibiting that commission from actually looking at the judge's decisions. And I would ask the members to look briefly at lines 8.28 and 8.29 and 8.30. which say the commission, which are the end of subdivision 5A, those lines say the commission may not evaluate judicial performance based on substantive legal issues or opinions subject to standard appellate processes. My concern, Mr. Chairman, is that almost every decision a judge makes is subject to standard appellate processes. So what we're saying, in essence, is that as a judge is making his decisions about who gets bail, who doesn't get bail, about what kind of sentences to give out, that all those issues are subject to appellate processes. The commission cannot take any of those considerations or take any of that into consideration in evaluating the judge. So to call this a judicial evaluation, performance evaluation commission, when the commission is forbidden to look at what the judge is actually doing, just seems insane to me. And I think it's going to create a fraud on the voters. If you want to say that they can look at the judges, the previous sentence says the things they can look at. The judges' among them are the judges' punctuality and communication skills. But that's not what the voters are concerned about. The voters are concerned about, is this judge doing what he's supposed to be doing? As I practiced law for 30 years, I've seen judges who routinely do not follow the sentencing guidelines, which are set out by the legislature in statute, but they don't follow them. Now, that's subject to appeal. Shouldn't the voters know that we have a judge out there who refuses to follow the sentencing guidelines? That's perhaps putting people back out onto the criminals back out onto the street that the sentencing guidelines would indicate should go to jail? Isn't that important? I think that's critical. Those are my comments, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody else? Thank you so much. Anybody else who would like to testify at this time? Okay. Senator Rest, thoughts?
Well, Mr. Chairman, with regard to the standards and procedures, just a comment from about Mr. Wurzels. He mentioned punctuality and communication skills, but also what the Performance Evaluation Commission will be looking at is knowledge of the law, procedure, integrity, impartiality, temperament, respect for litigants, respect for the rule of law, and administrative skill. In the current statute with regard to judicial selection, what that commission with regard to, it's not only Judge Miles said it was with regard to the district court judges, but that commission also operates for the workers' comp court as well. But they include knowledge of the law, integrity, and temperament, at least those three of the ones that are mentioned here as well. So there's a longer list here of the things for the for the commission to look at, but indeed specifically not to regard how a judge acts, makes a decision on a particular case. That's not what they're being asked to do.
Senator Rest, for those of us who are not lawyers, what does 28230 say?
What do you mean? Where are you looking?
The language, 8.28 to 8.30, the language Mr. Wurzel just pointed out.
I was thinking it was, we have 280 is one of the sections of law, so I was just thinking that you mean the, it means that, as I understand it, and I'm not an attorney either, as you know, that if a, well, for example, in West Virginia right now, there was a judicial contest in which, and it is a contested election there, in which one of the candidates promised that if he were elected, he would rule against, or he would rule in favor of, a particular West Virginia corporation that was involved in a suit before the court. There was a lot of money spent in that race, and it happens to be, as I understand it, a person that's involved in the ownership of the mine where the disaster just occurred. The candidate that he supported won the election, and indeed the court was then not evenly split, and the decision was made in favor of that corporation. That person had indicated ahead of time that how they were going to vote on, or at least what their position was with regard to that case. It would be the same thing as this group would be asked to say, well, did that judge make a correct decision on any court, on any case before it? For example, again, in Minnesota, as I understand it or recall, the decision to affirm the Senate recount, the U.S. Senate recount, was unanimous by the Supreme Court. What the Judicial Evaluation Commission would not be able to do as part of rating someone qualified or unqualified is to say, we don't agree with judges or Justice X's position on that recount decision. They would not be allowed to do that as part of their evaluation procedures.
So, Rest, I wonder, would Mr. Brisbois take a stab at that question a little? Because the language is pretty specific. Substantive legal issues or opinions subject to standard appellate
court cannot be
processes.
Yeah, cannot be. I don't think I got it wrong, but Leo, you tell him if I did.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Rest was essentially correct. By subject to appellate process would mean the judges make, let me back up just a little bit.
Standard appellate processes.
They make decisions all the time, all day long, all 5 days a week. There are clearly established rules of civil procedure, rules of appellate procedure, which define what is an appealable order or decision. And so that language would be controlled by the rules of procedure, both civil and appellate, that are already in place that lawyers operate under every day to define, and the members of the commission would have that same structure that's already in place to define that language for them. If the order or decision of the judge was appealable to the intermediate appellate court, then it would fall under that language. If it was then from the Court of Appeals subject to discretionary review by the Supreme Court, then it would fall under that language.
But this, maybe I'm the only one that's not quite understanding here, but this says you may not evaluate those things. And so the way you just described it to me, pro thing. This is a no. You can't do that.
Well, my reading of the language is that this is first of all the things that can be reevaluated. You know,
Those seem pretty straightforward.
Yeah. may not is a, it may not in this context, as I read this language, as I would argue this if I were, you know, interpreting statutory construction, would be the same effect as a shall. I mean, I think it has the same meaning.
Yeah. We get that.
Yeah.
So what is it that they can't evaluate?
And that's what I'm saying. Until we had the particular decision in front of us, you know, as to the jury issues of jury verdict, and there's a motion for a new trial which is denied. The motion for new trial is appealable. The commission could not look at that order and memorandum denying that motion for new trial on the merits under this language and say they got it wrong, therefore they get a less than qualified or qualified, you know, evaluation, because that order denying that new trial is an appealable order under the rules of procedure that are now presently in place. So, you know, that's as about as specific as an example as I can give you without having a case in front of us.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson?
I'm trying to reconcile both Mr. Wurzel's testimony and what you're saying here. Is there no room in performance evaluation for some understanding of the scope or the nature of cases that judge dealt with? You know, when you know, they're a nice person, they showed up to work on time, they're qualified, this kind of thing is, you know, I think we'd kind of hope that would be all that we would be judged on in an election for re-election. But, you know, there is something substantive about what we do that has an impact on how we're viewed and what people would view as being informed. And when you say performance evaluation, I don't think they look at just that. Isn't there something more in between these two statements that should be a part of a performance evaluation that would be helpful and informative to voters in making that kind of a decision?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, that's why I read off
the other things that the commission must take into consideration. And as a matter of fact, they're also allowed to consider additional things that they would agree on. What they couldn't do is what Mr. Brisbois said. So knowledge of the law, certainly. Procedure, that they know civil procedure or criminal procedure. That they are persons of integrity, that they have demonstrated impartiality. Their temperament can be evaluated. Their respect for litigants, their respect for the rule of law, and administrative skill. But, you know, sometimes showing up on time is important. And one of the reasons why a member of the Performance Evaluation Commission can be removed is by not showing up at meetings to which they have been called. So that, you know, that is that's certainly not the most important thing, but I think those other qualities are ones that speak to the issue you just raised.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator S., that's what I was. I need to ponder on this, and I haven't done that much, and I'm glad we are holding it over for further consideration as to whether those encompass, I think, some of the kinds of things that would make people feel informed in making that decision. And I'm not trying to, you know, it's not a gotcha kind of thing, but whether you're talking about a kind of specific situation of areas that could be appealable that you don't want the submission intervening and messing with.
Mr. Chairman and Senator.
Senator Rest, if I could, Mr. Watson has pointed something out that clarifies it for me.
Okay.
If you put substantive legal issues or opinions as if that's one thing, just put parentheses around that. Substantive legal issues or opinions that are subject to appellate processes. So what this says is don't evaluate things that are already reviewable by the courts.
Exactly.
That makes sense to me now. Is that what this says?
It is the notion, Mr. Chairman, that the commission is not evaluating whether a judge's decision was correct or incorrect, for that matter, but whether that person has demonstrated competence in holding the office.
But Senator Rist, I think with regard to this language, and Senator Cohen, is that how you read this? Mr. Watson just pointed out, why would you duplicate the evaluation if there already is a process for evaluating substantive legal issues and opinions, and that's the appellate process? Is that how this reads?
That's what it sounds like to me.
Okay.
So does that make sense then, do you
think?
Makes
sense to me now.
Does that language need
Mr.
clarification?
Mr. Watson pointed that out to me. Does it need clarification? I don't know.
Seems like to me it is a common understanding.
Did the lawyers all understand that beforehand?
I think they say they're, yeah.
Your Honor, those non-lawyers understood what that meant.
I think to simplify it in one sentence, we're not to be judged on the outcome of our decisions. We're to be judged on how we get to them.
Okay. So if I could ask, Your Honor, real quick. So that language, 28 to 30, from your perspective and the district court's perspective, seems like a reasonable or smart thing to have in here.
As a matter of fact, this has been, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this language has been vetted by the American Bar Association, which passed off on it decades ago. This is their template for how to judge the performance of judges.
Okay. So, thank you. Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you added two words. Now, I realize that it can mean the same thing, but is that too redundant to say that our subject instead of just saying subject to?
I know, Mr. Watson. Would you add that our subject?
Or is that something if Senator Frederickson was here, he would argue with me about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't think that would hurt at all, and if it would help. I think
that for some reason that kind of opens that thought of puts a little spread there so that you understand.
Okay, Senator Rest. Mm-hmm. Senator Olson moves that on 8.29 after the word opinions, insert that are. Your Honor, is that?
I think that's helpful.
Okay. Mr. Wurzel, does that improve it from your opinion or not?
Not at all.
Okay. You have a larger issue there. Okay.
Again, I want you to understand, a judge's sentences are appealable.
To the microphone, please. Sorry.
Sure.
Mr. Wurzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fact that something is appealable isn't really the solution. I want you to understand that an appeal costs thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and takes months and months and months. So if you have a judge who does not follow the law repetitively and, let's say, doesn't follow sentencing guidelines, yes, everybody can appeal the sentence. But in the meantime, the person who should have gone to prison is out on the street for months. Take another example. A judge determines who's going to get child custody. Is the decision appealable? Absolutely. Now, while you're appealing it and spending thousands of dollars, and it takes months and months and months, you're without your child. And that issue cannot be considered by the commission. Now, again, I'm not talking about judges doing one thing wrong. I'm talking about that if you go out and practice law, you will see judges do things repetitively refuse to follow the sentencing guidelines. I've seen judges say, I don't care if there's precedent, whatever the Supreme Court said, I'm going to do what I want. And I've had them actually say that language. So, yes, you can appeal the judge's decision, but if they're flagrantly not following the law, then I think that's an issue that should be made available to the public when they decide whether to keep this judge on. My simple solution, Mr. Chairman, is strike that language. Strike that last sentence found on 8.29 and 8.30 and say that the Performance Commission can evaluate their performance, and then it makes sense to me. But let's actually evaluate their performance, because we may have a judge who is doing something bizarre or strange and not following the law and doing it repetitively, and the public needs to know that. And yes, it can be appealed, and so every time it's appealed, the judge's decision is struck down. But we can't get rid of that judge who's making all those bad decisions, because the commission is going to give him an A+ because he was punctual. And I think we need to look at what their decisions are. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Okay, let's first do the Senator Olson amendment. Or do you want?
I think we did.
Well, we haven't voted on it yet.
Oh, okay.
So on the Olson amendment on 0.29 to add after the word opinions, that are, further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay, Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the discussion that we're having here, and I have to admit, as recently as last week, I've gotten a call from a constituent, and I've had numerous over years of what recourse does one have when it appears that the law is straightforward and a person can't get justice, that the judge will not rule or take any action that would enforce that. Whether it's, you know, property issues, sometimes it is the parental rights issues. And the only recourse is that appellate process that people have, that these are people that can't afford. So I understand that aspect of it too. So I don't know if it gives me pause as to whether some aspect or dimension of that level of performance, if it is a pattern, must be ignored.
Okay. Senator Rest, is there anything else today? I think we will allow members to think about this for a while.
That's fine. We have spoken about that before the committee. Just one more comment about the
Senator Rest.
Question.
Okay.
The question, as I mentioned at the beginning, did evolve, and we listened in both
the Judiciary Committee and made changes there, and listened to testimony in state and local government and made changes there, responding to some of the criticisms, including some made by Mr. Wurzel, and we made changes in the question based on his comments last year, in part. But the notion that you cannot... and perhaps Senator, Mr. Chairman, you know this better than others. The question on the ballot last year made an affirmative statement about whether or not to increase the sales tax based on what it was going to be used for. So the notion that it is somehow inappropriate to say that we would reaffirm the impartiality of the judiciary and that ought to be removed. I don't believe that it's very common that for that to have happened in other constitutional amendments, and certainly not the one that we most recently passed, which affirmed the purposes for which the sales tax was going to be increased. And so that language was in front of the voters right at the beginning of the amendment. It didn't say, shall we raise your taxes? I'm going to vote to raise my taxes and then put what it was going to be used for as part of the emphasis. I don't have that language in front of me, but I know, and certainly Senator Cohen, the same, very intimately involved in that amendment as well. So I think that it that language is extremely appropriate and has a precedent in the most recent constitutional amendment that the people of Minnesota voted on. And then that's the end of my comments, Mr. Chairman.
What's the part in the previous constitutional amendment that's similar to that language?
I don't have it in front of me, but...
It said the purposes for which the money would be used.
Yes, as a positive statement about why people should consider voting for the amendment.
Senator Ress, I'm just wondering, I haven't given a lot of thought to this yet, but reaffirm the impartial. I absolutely understand that that language that allows people to think positively about the amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I get that.
Yes.
I'm wondering, though, that if reaffirm the impartiality isn't a little presumptuous.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
In a judgment as to.
Again, when we started.
I'm not sure. I'm just.
Yes.
I do wonder about that particular idea.
Mr. Chairman, that's why I had wanted to go to the evolution of the question. We started with a question that said, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to preserve the independence? Now, it seemed like to me that at some point that was presumptuous, as if we were going to lose that rather than reaffirming the independence. But we took out that word, to preserve the independence of Minnesota's judges by allowing voters to decide whether judges shall be retained in a retention election after a public performance evaluation by a nonpartisan panel. One of the criticisms was not so much the beginning of it, but that we did not tell the voters what we had in place at the current time. And so we added eventually then language that let them know that under the current system we have contested elections. So not trying to say, well, what do we have now? No, we're telling them what we have now in the current question. And then we move from there to just saying, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended from the current system to asking voters to decide whether Minnesota judges shall be retained in retention election after a public performance evaluation by a nonpartisan panel? Once again, no mention of the current system. And then going to certainly an affirmative statement, but looking at the precedent of the most recent constitutional amendment, and then actually spelling it out. It's not just a retention election. It is indeed, and maybe some people would criticize it because the question's too long, but responding to those who said, people have to know exactly what it is you're proposing. And it's not just a retention election. It is indeed judges being appointed by the governor, that they are evaluated by an independent performance evaluation commission, and that is being suggested to the voters to make a decision on over the current contested elections. And so there have been compromises on the language throughout, and I think that the people that have been involved in that, and even the district court judges, have been making suggestions with regard to that language. Now, people who don't want the retention elections at all, of course, are going to continue to find fault with any language we would have. But I believe that we have we've come up with a question that makes sense to the voters, that the voters, having in reading it, will understand that we're not talking about the that our current system is corrupt, and so it's not saying that we should amend to get rid of a corrupt system. It is saying that we understand that we have an impartial system and that we're reaffirming it, but we're going to do it in a different, we're suggesting that it be done in a different manner. And if you don't think it ought to be done in a different manner, then you would vote no.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, just one thought, words, and just throwing it out. To me, if you said it amended to reaffirm the importance of an impartial judiciary by providing, kind of takes away some of that particular cloud. But I haven't had time to dig out the language, but I'll never forget the year I was elected, almost 100 years ago now. There were several ballot questions on, and there was one that passed. And I honestly believe that people that voted for it thought it would have a different outcome. It was the one that allowed the legislature to limit campaign expenditures. Set the limits on campaign expenditures. And I think people thought, well, they can the first action that happened in that next legislative session is that they doubled the limit on how much could be spent on campaigns. I don't think that was what was expected, but that language very definitely was couched in a way that I think may have influenced how they looked at it, because that was the only amendment question that passed that year. And it seemed amusing to me, because I'm not sure that that's what they thought they were voting for. But we may never know that. But I was going to try to dig out and find that language, because language does make a difference. And I think I think
absolutely.
We should be as honest as we can and be straightforward in what is being done. And
that's why the question is so long. That's why the question is so long.
Okay, I think we've had a good discussion. I'm thinking Tuesday?
Mr. Chairman, you know, my committee is going to be hearing the bill dealing with, I know it's a late bill, but with the merit selection on Wednesday. I wonder if the Rules Committee would prefer to meet after that hearing was, or whether you're indifferent to it.
We're open to that. What I don't want to do is just let this go on and on and on.
Right.
At some point, we want to vote on it.
And perhaps in because we're meeting like Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday next week.
No, Senator Ress, I'm just thinking.
No, I'm just saying
it doesn't matter, because I think the issue on that is some people don't think it'll ever become law, even if it does pass out of your committee.
Okay.
So I don't know that it
that
really
makes any difference. Well, then. We can work with your office and what the schedule would be, it would be good to have it again next week.
Right now, I was thinking maybe Tuesday.
That would be fine.
We would probably take this up. We need to look at committee schedules, though, because this is a very important issue, and I want to make sure all Rules Committee members are able to be here. So what we'll look at, I don't know what your schedule is next week. You meet in the morning, so like a Tuesday afternoon might work. Okay. But that's not for certain, but perhaps Tuesday afternoon. So,
well, then, Mr. Chairman, we would then keep our Wednesday afternoon 15 minutes after session is over on Wednesday afternoon for the bill on